Hello, my name is Asia Nesbitt, and I am the clinical liaison for the APLS Student Committee. I had the privilege of moderating a panel at the annual APLS conference in Los Angeles this year, titled Bridging the Gap Between Virtual Assessment Development and Implementation. This audio is that conversation. I will introduce the panelists now, and for the purposes of this audio format, we'll read out their names in the order that you will first hear from them, so that you may familiarize yourself with their voices. Dr. Alexandra Lugo is a psychologist with the California Department of State Hospitals Metropolitan in Los Angeles, California, where she is now a staff psychologist. Dr. Lugo co-developed a suicide risk assessment smartphone application for use by police officers in guiding their risk determinations and decision-making. She recently served as a member on the APLS Telepsychology Task Force. Dr. Anna Belmonte is the chair of the Division of Forensic Psychology at the Chicago School. Her research interests include evaluation and assessment with forensic populations, competency to stand trial restoration, issues related to family law and families in conflict. Prior to her current role, Dr. Belmonte served as the director of assessment and research at the Chicago School Forensic Center, where she launched the center's telehealth assessment program. Dr. Ashley Battistini is an associate professor in the Center for Forensic Behavioral Science at Swinburne University of Technology. Her work broadly focuses on novel intervention strategies for higher risk populations and ways to improve access to appropriate services at various stages of criminal legal involvement. Dr. Battistini is currently a member of APA's Office of Healthcare Innovation Advisory Committee for Mental Health Technology, and recently co-chaired the APLS Telepsychology Task Force. Dr. Glenn Lipton is a board-certified professional psychologist and a recognized expert in forensic psychology. He spent 3 decades tackling violence from all fronts in preventing, intervening, and providing opinions in cases involving violent crimes. As an expert witness, speaker, and advisor, he has testified in court martials and regulatory hearings, and submitted briefs through counsel to the United States Supreme Court. Laura Stevens is a PhD student completing her doctorate at the University of Birmingham in the UK. During her PhD, Laura has validated a mobile phone application that gathers memory evidence from survivors of sexual and gender-based violence on the ground in Kenya. This research is in collaboration with the Wangu Kanja Foundation in Kenya, who co-designed all aspects of the research and implemented it in practice on the ground. You can find full bios for our wonderful speakers in the description of this recording. Now, into the discussion.
I'm Asia. I'm the clinical liaison this year with APLS Student Committee. We have a small group, but we are recording for the purposes of doing a podcast, so I'm really hoping for this to be kind of discussion-based, so feel free to bounce off one another. I'm just wondering if we can start, if all of you can begin by kind of introducing your work in integrating virtual care and assessment services, whether that be in a clinical setting or research settings.
Well, I guess as you mentioned when you introduced me, I, as part of my dissertation, developed a suicide risk assessment app, largely for police to use when they encounter people in crisis. It uses a structured professional judgment approach to kind of combine both actuarial items, predictors of risk for suicide, including cultural risk and protective factors, and also kind of guides the user to make their own determinations of low, moderate, or high risk for both static and dynamic scales. The idea is that police will use this when they encounter people in crisis, and it helps them determine if someone is risky enough to initiate a psychiatric hold, and hopefully to make their hold strong given the documentation that also produces.
I think, like everybody in the entire world, COVID changed a lot of things. And prior to COVID, I wasn't doing a lot of telehealth. Everybody kind of was like, nope, we're not doing that. That's not the best way to gather data. But I was a supervisor in a training program when that started, and we had trainees that we needed to make sure they got good training and they got good supervision, and they got the hours that they needed to move along in their program. And so kind of had to, again, not unique, but really had to implement some strategies to start working with individuals. We have on our training program at our school, the Forensic Center, most of our clients are court ordered. We have a state contract with the Illinois Department of Human Services to provide outpatient, it's fitness in Illinois. I don't know why, fitness restoration treatment services for individuals who can reside in the community. And so we had to continue seeing them. We had to continue doing their re-evaluations on a 90-day interval for the court. We were doing evaluations for family court, domestic relations court in Cook County, which were parenting capacities. Also just general evaluations that are ordered under those court jurisdictions. Doing therapeutic supervised visitation services, and so not just evaluation, but treatment services through all those models. But especially for, I was very concerned with our diagnostic students who were, they were, it's their first experience, you know, trying to learn a WISC, trying to learn WACE, and, you know, how do we make this shift in the middle, actually, it was, yeah, the middle-ish, but more towards the end of their training year and still make this kind of a fruitful experience for them. And there was guidance, but not a ton at the time. And so really trying to utilize what was available out there and make sure we're still, we want to teach our students something that they're going to continue doing for years to come that isn't right. And so just trying to make that work and scrambling and doing that all from home and from away from our teams. And yeah, I think that that's the main thing. We still, to this day, Olivia, who's a member of our student committee, was a trainee at our site last year, and still to this day do a lot of telehealth work, and you know, I've seen improvements in student in client engagement and whatnot. And so when it's appropriate, that's something that, you know, we continue to this day. But yeah, I guess that's kind of relevant, my relevant experience.
Hi, for the purpose of anybody listening on the podcast, this voice belongs to Ashley Battistini. My work with telehealth and technology in general actually started before the pandemic in my graduate program at Texas Tech. And I was, I don't know if it was in my first year or second year, somewhere along the lines where I was thinking about what my big old dissertation project was going to be. And I remember my advisor saying, hey, you know, you should kind of look into this telehealth area and how that might apply to corrections. That's kind of my main shtick is corrections. And so I was looking for a project that would have something to do with mental health and behavioral health treatment in those settings. And he brought this idea to me in a mentoring meeting. And my first reaction was not positive. I just did not, like many people, I think, at that time, and even at the beginning of the pandemic, did not really think that that was a great idea. And it just wasn't very interesting to me. I wanted to, you know, talk to people who were incarcerated, and I thought that was really kind of, you know, the interesting thing was to kind of have these in-person interactions. And he quickly said, you know, fix your face. And he had recently published an article in, I think it's Clinical and Consulting Psychology, on perceptions of telehealth, the telepsychiatry within the correctional system. And he said, look, this is my highest publication that I have. And so this is really, you know, I really think this is an area that's going to be big one day. And as an aspiring academic and research person, I thought, okay, maybe I should look into this. Maybe this would be, maybe he's right about this. You can't run a myth that your advisor's right, but they usually are. And so I'll save you the story of the dissertation that I eventually came up with, but it had to do with telehealth and the delivery of services for people in segregation or restricted housing. And we, it's probably a more ambitious project than I would recommend other people do, but it was kind of like a mini program evaluation, and we had people who were being seen through telehealth in a group format because it was a bit safer for them to have that physical distance, and then there were other people who were seen in their traditional in-person format, which again, because of the safety and security issues, there could only be two people in the quote unquote group. And so they were looking to try to use telehealth to expand their groups so they could treat more people and then have it be in a safer context. And long story short, we found that the there was no difference between the telehealth and the in-person conditions, but we also found that the treatment they were undergoing was not very effective. So anyway, so I kind of just, that was the start of my journey, I guess, into telehealth and technology. And so I think even before the pandemic, I had a bit of a different view on things than maybe some other clinicians and even researchers had at the time, where I really did start to see the potential of it. I never thought it should be something to replace in-person services, but I was starting to see the benefits in terms of access and cost effectiveness and things like that. And I guess since then I've kind of become, I don't know, a tech person, which I'm not like a techie really, so I don't actually know how to do any of this in real life. I just research it and get to talk about it. But I was with Dr. Lugo, was part of the APLS Telepsychology Task Force, where we just put out recommendations for the use of telehealth in psychology law context that talks both about forensic services but also correctional practice. I've done a few research studies looking at perceptions of telehealth. We've kind of, again, we're able to do a study before the pandemic hit, which I think served as a nice baseline for some of the other surveys that came out after COVID. We got to see, like, what do people think before and what did they think during? And I think there was a recent survey of practitioner use and perceptions just last year, and the trajectory was really interesting, because when we did our survey in 2019, I think it came out, the sentiment essentially was, we sort of don't really like this, but people who had used it felt better about it than the people who hadn't. And then some of the work that came out right after the COVID pandemic was more like, well, we don't really like it, but we don't really have a choice, and it's fine for what it is. And then the study that came out last year, I think, was in Behavioral Sciences and the Law, and they basically showed that people preferred forensic evaluations remotely because it's easier to do, and you can sit at home in your PJs and do it and get your work done. So it's been a bit of a trajectory, and there's some other things that I've done related to telepsychology, but I think I've talked too much, so I'll pass it along.
Since this is being recorded, I'll say my name also. So this is Glenn Gibson. So it's been a long road sort of getting involved with first the recognition that clinically we haven't necessarily taken histories and really looked at someone's digital engagement in life. And that's really important when we do assessment. So about 10 years ago, we came up with an instrument that we've been researching at San Diego State University, called the DDCL, which is the Daily Digital Connected Life. And what we began doing is looking at the amount of time that people either research, they spend a series of questions, the amount of apps they had, the amount of hours. And then what we began to do is to see how that interfaces with other common measures, you know, sort of like you do with research. So we were looking at such things as if you had higher ACE scores, were you more likely to spend time digitally online? So this group that I pulled together, that Catherine Turner basically was in charge of at the university, has been working on papers in that area. She went back to school, her PhD is from Stanford in developmental psychology. She went back to school to re-specialize in clinical, so she's had less time to necessarily help pull together the publications. But we now have years of data collected at three universities looking at these issues of what goes on. I've done presentations saying you have to determine what's going on in terms of the avatars or the false selves that people build online and how that potentially influences behavior. That then led to an involvement in something called Bridget Schools. So Bridget Schools was in three or four cities around the country, Miami, New York, California, Montana. And the basis was to set up a networking connection platform in schools where people could do shout outs and get awards for complimenting someone, saying what's going well in the school, etc. But monitoring the people who were not sending out shout outs or who were not seeing them and identifying them as high risk. And we were collecting data in terms of how that was affecting absenteeism, how it was affecting grades. And towards the end of COVID, it ran out of money because people stopped signing up for it because no one was in school at the time. So it's been temporarily shuttered and they start up again, but it was a really nice concept of helping people connect that way. There are a few instruments that we've created that we're in the process of norming. One is looking at range of emotional experience. If you know your couples therapy literature, Gottman talks about negative emotional flooding. And what we find is that people who engage in violence or having difficulties, they don't have a wide range of affect. So just on an app to fill in what you're experiencing then becomes a cultural assessment for schools. So we're in the process of collecting that data. The other element is looking at how people tell stories, something that was really important in psychology to begin with. We had something called the thematic apperception test, which maybe someone here has heard of, and which was Murray's instrument, with the concept that we organize all experiences narratively. That's why we like movies and we like books. So what I determined a long time ago forensically, I had a woman who killed her mother, and she filled out these future-based questions. You go on a vacation. She describes she gets to go to Disney World and see the computer that controls everything. So that issue of control kept going in. You go to a doctor. Here we have Occam's razor, the law of parsimony. The law of parsimony is it's your annual checkup. You know, that type of thing. If you go to the doctor and it's because he finds you with cancer and you're going to die and you only have a few months to live, that tells you their style of employment. So we have this measure now where you have the stems and you type the text you would send when that event happens in your life to try to assess that style of employment. So those are different measures that we've created to get a sense of where someone is online. Now, when I've done forensic assessments, I try to do something often that's blended if someone's out of state. Or I'll have someone do testing and assessment where that person is, and then maybe I will interview them remotely. And you have to be aware of the laws related to what you can do in that area and whether or not you could do it depending on licensure and the like. But that's something that I try to use when I have that opportunity. I still prefer to see someone in person, and I don't see that changing. I think that's because I'm a bit of a curmudgeon and I've been doing this so long that, you know, I like that opportunity to get together with people. One of the things that became very important when doing threat assessment, I was evaluating a kid. They found a picture of someone shot in the head, and what he wrote was, "If you're nice to me, you're fine. If not, you're dead." And they found bullets at his house, but not the guns. And one of the things that became important was to raise the money, we found out later, to get the guns. We didn't find them at the time, through what he was posting on YouTube. You could find his videos. He was iReap, like the Reaper, iReap ZZ Vids. And at that time, for each million viewers, you get $1,000 a month about. And he was able to use that to fund exactly what he was doing. I recognize that leakage and what goes on in the forensic context often happens online. This has been confirmed recently in a study that was done with the FBI and our police department in San Diego, where we found a certain pattern of online usage in people who we looked at before they commit mass shootings. So this use of big data had been used by people like Walmart, who would look at what people were looking at during hurricanes and make sure those were stocked in advance. They know based on what vitamins someone may be looking at if they're pregnant, and then that changes how they market them. So big data has been using this. So what we're now looking at is profiling what someone's engaged in, what they're involved in, because that creates an interaction that fuels a narrative and movement along the pathway to violence. So that's something we're now incorporating, working as a multidisciplinary team in preventing school shootings. So I see a rich, I see a lot of possibilities for what we could accomplish, not only virtually, but having assessments that look at these elements.
Hi, my name is Laura, for the purpose of the podcast, and as you can probably tell from my accent, I am British from the UK, so I hope that it's not too difficult to follow my Birmingham accent. So I'm slightly different from the other members of the panel, where my technological experience comes from the investigation side of things. So how are we capturing evidence from victims or survivors so you can eventually hopefully apprehend and then assess and help these offenders? Suspects, sorry, whatever words, clients, whatever word you would like to use. So the technology that I have used as part of my PhD, so again, to be very clear, I'm a PhD student. I will be finishing in about 3 months' time, hopefully, fingers crossed. So the work that we have been doing is taking a mobile phone application that is used from survivors of sexual violence on the ground in Kenya. So this was born out of the Me Too movement, where everybody was turning online to report what had happened to them. And from this, we saw a massive influx in online technologies, being both mobile phone applications and websites, where survivors could go to document what had happened to them. So unsurprisingly, individuals don't come forward to the police for a variety of reasons. So we were really interested in these online spaces that were, in essence, the first responses, the first place to capture their memory evidence. And interested in looking at how that memory evidence was captured, because the way that it is captured is potentially going to play a huge part if they ever seek criminal justice in the future. So is it captured in a way that is in line with the evidence that we have on face-to-face interviewing? And is it captured in a way that is trauma-informed and sensitive for the service user? So my PhD was looking at reviewing all of the applications and online technology that is out there to date that is accessible. So I can talk a little bit more about that and some of the ethical considerations behind that technology. And then taking the mobile technology that is implemented on the ground in Kenya and validating it. So we took it off the ground and we put it into a lab-based environment where we could control the stimuli and we could see, is it actually fit for purpose? Is it documenting memory evidence in a way that a police officer could use in the future? Spoiler alert, it does. You get really good memory evidence. And then we looked at ways that we wanted to improve it and we applied it back on the ground in Kenya with the survivors to document memory evidence. So that's the technology that we've been using. So we've been validating it and trialing it, but from more from an investigation point of view. But we were also very well aware of the fact that this mobile technology is not just useful for that criminal justice element. We also ask questions about what services survivors have accessed, because we're really interested in attrition throughout the system. So if they do seek help at a healthcare facility or at the police, what happens to them afterwards? Where do they go? And in essence, who's dropping the ball? And where do we need to start implementing more intervention to make sure that we're helping these vulnerable people on the ground? So that's a little bit.
Yes, thank you. You must have read my questions because you use the term ethical considerations. And I think that's what I'm curious about. I think all of you alluded to that, you know, whether that is Dr. Lugo doing, thinking about cultural considerations when developing an app, or I'm sure telehealth to folks in ADSEG. Ethical considerations, it's a new layer of ethical considerations in this work. And I'm curious about what you know is being done and what you're thinking about, and also steps that we need to take and collectively think about as a community to ensure that we are remaining ethical in the work that we're now delivering online.
Thank you. So in the work that I'm doing with survivors of sexual violence, one of the big ethical considerations that came out of the review that we did that's published and I'm happy to share is we were really considering ownership of data. So when we give our data over to these cloud servers, who has ownership over that data and where does it go? It's something that we really need to be careful of. So when reviewing these applications and online technology, it really was not clear to the service user where their data was being held. So in very few of the applications was it made very explicitly clear. And as you said, when things actually, they lose funding and they might shut down for certain periods of time, where does the data go? How do you get your data back off that server? So that was one of the massive ethical considerations that we're really thinking about moving forward, is how can we be upfront and honest about who can access the data, where it gets stored, but also what is going to happen to that data if anything happens to that technological platform. So that is something that we're really considering. The additional thing that we are also considering from an ethical point of view is security measures. I'm sure that comes as no great surprise, but a scary finding of my review was that only 50% of the applications or online technology that we reviewed actually had any form of security measure. So any form of password protection, sign-in, anything like that. So when the service user wanted to access the platform or access their data later on, anyone who can access their phone was able to see the reports that they were writing. Yeah. So that was a really, really scary finding from our point of view. And one of our largest recommendations is that we need to be really, really careful about the security of the platforms that we're offering.
I think so. I have a couple different perspectives because I'm also an educator as well as former supervisor. And so I think from both a supervisor perspective and then now being an educator where we're sending students into training experiences and we're on the school side of it, I think, I mean, we all already know about kind of the ethical considerations of ensuring, you know, this is the person we're actually talking to or who's in the room. But at a higher level with student trainees and giving them good training is we need to train students for both. For both situations, telehealth and in-person still, and straddle both. We have a lot of sites nowadays that are wanting to, their practice has moved pretty much all telehealth, but we want to make sure our students are still getting the training in both realms, that they're getting still proper supervision through, you know, maybe not being as much on-site as they previously were. As from a supervisor's perspective, similarly, like, you know, we were talking about data security. Okay, during COVID or during any time, you're now maybe taking materials home with you that you never used to have, you never used to take home, or you're using your personal computer for things you weren't previously doing, buying computers that we never used to give out to trainees because we need to do that. So, and to keep our data secure. So I feel like there's a lot of a whole other level of, like you said, ethical concerns from a lot of different perspectives, not just the direct service that's being provided to clients through telehealth, but also what goes on behind the scenes to support that direct service and ensuring that that's still being done ethically. You know, as a student, you guys are all familiar, you may not live by yourself. You may be living with, you know, people who are also providing telehealth services. So how are you making sure your space is still private, your clients are still getting you know, the care that they would have gotten in an office setting, and really talking to students and trainees about that, and really integrating these topics now into the classroom too before students get go on to training. So I teach a class right now called Forensic Documentation, Report Writing, and Testifying, and I've added a whole component to that class about testifying virtually because that's something we never had to do before and get on Zoom. And, you know, that doesn't mean, yes, your pants can be maybe real comfy, but you're still going to present yourself. It's still a courtroom. There's still a court reporter on there. Like, it's, you got to have that mindset still. And you might have to make adjustments even to how you present yourself to ensure, you know, you're getting your point across in a different way through a computer. And so, I mean, I think, yeah, integrating all of these things from the very beginning stages of a student's academic program is something we were not previously doing 5, 6, 7 years ago, and now it's a whole part of ethics and academics to ensure that students are properly trained.
Yeah, a couple of points. You want to go first? Okay, sure. Okay. The American Counseling Association, as part of their code of ethics, has a whole section on digital ethics that's worth reading. So does, this is the newest code for profession that never had a code of ethics, the 2015. That was the first time that teachers had a code of ethics. You don't want to confuse a code of conduct with a code of ethics, and they only had a code of conduct. Sometimes it was called a code of ethics, but it was a code of conduct. And so that talks about the responsible use of ethics, so of digital devices. One of the things that we've run into is, and we ran into this with COVID with teachers in schools, was the issue of mandated reporting based on what you could see when you're doing counseling and what happens with that. There's also issues about whether you do Google searches or other things into your clients and whether that's an invasion of privacy. So these are all areas that need discussion in graduate training and people who definitely work in schools. Because when you come to someone's house, there's an element of being able to see so much more than you would ever see if they came to your house. And how do you ethically handle that information and take into account what you might overhear or what you might see? Do you feel if you see syringes, and they could be related to drug use, which is tied in with the highest area of mandated reporting, which is neglect, people who are intoxicated really tend to neglect those in their environment. And if there are signs of that, holes and walls and all that, what does that create for you as a mandated reporter? These are things you have to think about in advance. And I like the point you made with data breaches. Look what just happened with 23andMe, where you had people's DNA information stolen. And you've also had data breaches at Sony and all over, because we have government entities that are working on overriding two-factor authentications and different ways of doing things. So security is something that keeps rotating. Right now, for example, they suggest that you use codes that have words rather than letters and numbers and symbols, because they found that they're able to crack them within a week with some of the supercomputers to get in. So it's a very frightening time in terms of how we protect that data and how, and the recognition that we're able to collect much more information than potentially we want. And in addition, people are able to collect more information on us. So there's a whole ethical piece in terms of what we post about our lives with pictures. I would always tell my graduate students, be careful what you post, because through open access, people are able to go into Facebook or elsewhere, and that picture of you being someone intoxicated at a party can be shown when you go to testify later. So we have to be careful, and we're walking in a whole new digital frontier.
Yeah, I was just going to add to the discussion about training and supervision and put in a little bit of a plug for our recommendations that we had published, open access, by the way, in Psychology, Public Policy, and Law, where we do have a section where we talk about education, training, and supervision. Obviously, it's not an exhaustive document pertaining to that side of things, but maybe Alex can second. But I think it's a good place to start, and certainly not something that the APA telepsychology guidelines really adequately addressed. And that was the reason why we had, that this task force within our division was formed, because there was this gap between the forensic practice guidelines and the APA telepsychology guidelines. These are not guidelines, by the way. One thing we learned on our task force is that guidelines are a very specific thing within APA, but they are a set of recommendations that was endorsed by the division and our executive committee, and I think that's a good place to start in thinking about how to incorporate supervision. We also, one thing we talk about in there, for example, is having performance evaluations also reflect students' knowledge of how to navigate a virtual environment, or having them practice virtual testimony in a virtual courtroom, and those kinds of things. We talked a little bit about the benefits of that, and also being mindful of things like Zoom fatigue and other kinds of things that can impact students when they're working in that environment. I know part of this panel is also talking a little bit about AI and some of the ethics around that, and I certainly think there are some unknown territory with that, especially when it comes to, I've had conversations with people about the use of things like ChatGPT to write forensic reports, and we actually had an idea for a study, maybe some of you might steal it, that's fine, of having, pulling an actual forensic evaluation and then having ChatGPT write one and seeing if forensic practitioners could tell me.
I sent one of mine, a piece of mine, because I was trying to figure out if one of my students used AI or not, and how to, if, and to see if AI could detect it. So I put in a copy and paste of one of my forensic reports from 2015 before like AI ever existed, and I said, did AI write this? And they're like, yes, it did. And I wrote back to it, I'm like, no, it didn't. I wrote it in 2015. So I would be so interested to see how that works.
All right, well, we just made our first collaboration up here in real time. So we haven't gotten around to doing it yet. But yeah, I mean, this is kind of, I don't have any real answers. I might just be rambling here, but there's kind of a cost benefit or maybe a trade-off with AI that it's, my personal perspective is to be sort of cautiously optimistic about it and how it might help with things like efficiency and maybe accuracy and things of that nature, but obviously these things also come with the potential for misuse or overuse. Mm-hmm. Or people relying solely on these sorts of things as opposed to using them as assistance and supports to their work. This discussion of AI obviously expands beyond forensic and corrections or psychology law in general. If anybody, I don't know if folks pay much attention to the Monitor on Psychology, the APA. But pretty much every year since I've been paying attention to this topic area, their trends report always highlights something to do with technology, and AI was obviously in there. And that came out in January of this year. And I would encourage people to kind of read it because it really does present a good balanced perspective of the potential for AI, but also the role that psychologists can and should play in the proliferation of it. And it's something that's here already, and it's hard to stop it. And so thinking about, kind of coming back to the discussion of ethics, but thinking about how we can leverage things like AI or other forms of technology to benefit the clients that we work for and to benefit the general public, and then also what we can do as a community of people under the umbrella of psychology law to try to keep out the bad things and make sure that it is being used ethically and to keep our students in check and sure that things not being put out there that are inaccurate or don't reflect the science in the field.
So. Yeah, along with that, and just this being reported, just a quick note, I de-identified before I put in AI, but I think that is the key that students sometimes don't think about is the things that, and that we have to clearly state as educators of, like, AI is generative and is being used in so many ways. Like, you need to be mindful of what you're putting in there as well, because it learns from you. And so keeping with the ethics, don't put in sensitive information in there at all. And I think to what Dr. Bradstein was talking about, I've seen students, like the class I was just telling you about, forensic documentation reporting, testifying, we're teaching them how to write a forensic report. One of the skills that they were being graded on was how to write a summary. My student used AI to write the summary. And I'm like, well, that might be something to potentially think about as a clinician who's licensed to help you with a skill you already have. But if you don't have the skill already, don't rely on a technology to give you the skill, essentially. I think the only way we can ethically use technology is that we need to know how to do things ourselves. It's just like statistics or math. We needed to learn how to do 1 + 1 without a calculator, so we understood the math behind it, even if it was frustrating. And it's like, I never go anywhere nowadays without a calculator. It's on our phone. But you need to know the foundations before you use assistive technologies in any way to support your work.
I was just going to, maybe you should add first because I'm going to pivot a tiny bit.
Okay. So, so most AI depends on an engine that's separate from what you record. And that engine is what looks at what's on the internet, what's been published, and what's out there. The problem we have is we don't know how it generates it, what it looked at, what went into it. And the courts have not liked programs like ABLE that determines whether or not someone's a sex offender if you can't describe how it works. So it's not accepted as admissible. So the issue with AI is you have to rely on that search engine that you have no idea how it works. And it's better if you learn how to do the inferences as you suggested and write those sections rather than rely on it. It's like never learning how to add without a calculator. Yeah, you could always have a calculator, but it's important to know what the calculator is doing.
Sorry, I have something on that topic, but just before you put it. I'm so sorry, I'm writing notes as well because my working memory is not as quick as you are. So if you see me, I'm not being rude, I'm not texting, I'm just making notes so I don't forget. But with exactly what you've just said, I think with all of our work, whether it's technology without AI or now with AI, because AI is here, it's about making sure that we have steering groups or working groups whereby we're actually including both the service users and, so in my case, that'd be survivors of sexual violence, but also the attorneys, the prosecutors are involved. So when we created our technology and we're going to introduce AI elements to that technology in the future, it's making sure that that is what the service user is going to be comfortable using and is going to be happy participating in. Otherwise, if they don't buy in, it won't be successful. And it's making sure that the attorneys are with us every step of the way, telling us this is not going to be admissible. This is going to get absolutely, you know, annihilated at court. And that is going to, you know, actually traumatize your service user further. So we have working groups right the way from day dot of the inception of the project to is when we eventually get there. We're hoping that we might bypass some of these problems of admissibility.
Okay, I wanted to pivot just a tiny bit back to another plug for the recommendations. and then we kind of had to like raise issues related to additional privacy and confidentiality concerns that come when you're implementing telehealth with vulnerable populations, particularly in correctional settings. So I think like we kind of brainstormed a lot of ways to mitigate some of those concerns. But additionally, when we're talking about vulnerable populations out in the community, like for example, parolees who are mandated to be still participating in telehealth, if they, for example, don't have access to like a cell phone or a private space to be engaging in therapy, like what does that look like? And how do we still hold them accountable for that responsibility if we can't give them a private space and the other tools that they need to access it? So. Just, I guess, some food for thought, just considering some of these additional issues that get raised. And then in terms of developing technology and some ethical considerations, I think sometimes we think about, we see a problem in the community and we have like a technological solution for it, and we forget a little bit about the end user. And so I think that another important component is collaborating with that population that you're trying to help. Like, for example, with the law enforcement officers and developing the app for them, we came in with like all these grand ideas about how they would use it. And one of the first things they brought up in one of our first focus groups was, well, how am I going to be like handling an app and also have access to like my weapon if I need to protect myself? We're like, well, we hadn't really thought about that, like in our academic bubble. So I think it's really important to collaborate with the exact population that you're trying to help. And have some humility when you're trying to help them, you know, develop solutions instead of assuming that this technological solution is going to, like, you know, answer all their questions. So,
thank you. I really appreciate also ending on that note, like bringing all folks to the table, especially when we know that AI is inherently made by individuals and therefore biased in its own right. So I just kind of wanted to highlight and appreciate that. And it also makes me think maybe next year we have a whole ethical conversation because I think we could go for a while on that one specifically. I'm curious, we've kind of talked about challenges, and if there's things that continue to come up that you want to speak on regarding challenges, feel free to use that time. But I am curious about the flip side of that, which is what has been really valuable in this experience, and even moving forward, what are you hoping to see in the work that you all are doing?
I think, as I've kind of mentioned before, we see individuals who struggle to access services have higher access to services now. I work in the city of Chicago, and our campus location is in downtown, but it's expensive to get to, or far away to get to, even for people who live within the city limits. They might have to take a bus, a train, and then another bus, or we have individuals who don't have family supports in the community necessarily, and so there's not somebody who can drive them. And so to have an option for telehealth services, I think has, we've seen increased cooperation and increased adherence to court mandated services in certain circumstances. I won't say it's a cure-all to the troubles that we face in an outpatient setting of getting people into, you know, the building or into the computer, if you will. But I think that that has been a benefit. And I know we said we're focusing on benefits, but I do want to emphasize one flip side is still those privacy concerns, because a lot of the clients we encounter, whether it be on the fitness side or the family services side, are residing in a home with a lot of people potentially, or not a lot of private spaces. And I think this is very prevalent in some of our court mandated family cases, where we're doing therapeutic supervised visitation, or not really that service. It's more one of the one-on-one services with the kid who's living in the home of, you know, the custodial parent, but they need to talk about the non-custodial parent, and there's maybe some contention there, and, you know, trying to, and it's a young child, so they're not maybe necessarily able to assert themselves with the parent who's potentially the problem, and, you know, make sure that they have a private space to conduct their own, you know, therapy. So I think, like I said, we've seen access, but there are still individuals who it's just not a suitable service for. But I think it's something that is an incredible asset that we now have, that is so much more widely accepted than it was previously.
I just want to second your first point about positives, that for me, this technology has just been a massive, massive benefit in allowing survivors' voices to be heard in a space where they're not typically heard. So if we've helped anyone to be able to actually tell their experience, then that's something I'm grateful for. And in particular, with that and kind of moving forward, is continuing to empower them and provide them with sustainable solutions on the ground. That's something that I'm, you know, really happy with this work, is to allow them to be heard and to train and to empower them to continue this forward, because academics, we have a tendency to have to move where the funding is. So if that happens with me, going back to consequences, where I have to move to a different postdoc or move to a different position, I'm really considering my benefit to be, how have I left a sustainable legacy on the ground whereby they can continue this and they can continue to move with this after I've potentially had to move on to another job, even though they know I'll always be there for them.
The reporting apps that have been used, Stop It Solutions now has 2 call centers. They've added sexual harassment and others, and these are for kids. They have prevented school shootings, and they have prevented suicides by the ability to respond. One of the ethical issues we have here is, what really is anonymous? Because when all hell breaks loose, sometimes the person who writes something is no longer anonymous. We have to be careful that we don't want to sell things as more than they are. But there's stuff, WeTip went private. That's another equivalent to Stop It Solutions. RAIN is for the military. These all have a lot of, we've already seen the success of having reporting apps. And we saw that with the Me Too movement. A bridge created with a platform for one of the silence breakers for reporting sexual misconduct. And the issue becomes one of, when people realize they're not alone, that's really strong. And the Trevor Project is one of those that has done it. One of the challenges is age. And that is, when you're dealing with geriatric and other populations, sometimes they're not so comfortable using these devices. So we have to be aware of age discrimination. We have to be aware the impact of systemic racism and poverty in terms of privacy and access to devices. One of the problems I've had as a teacher is inevitably there's a student who's trying to participate while driving if there's an online course. And I've had discussions with the attorney of the university. Are we liable? I'm lecturing. I'm not necessarily.
We have it in our school policies that it's not allowed.
That it's not allowed. But when they do it, if I don't stop immediately, how did I mess up? And I'll have students write me later. But the same thing happens when I supervise students, in that the student is doing their therapy session on their phone while riding with their parents. How do you, you know, because their parent has another child to pick up, and part of that's income, and they don't have privacy in the house. So that sometimes interferes with our ability to use telehealth or media, video type health, and that's an issue. Part of the fun has been the challenge of doing it, and that is we'll use draw erase boards to do mutual drawings. We'll use chat to do hangman. It's really fun to come up with ways to have kids engage when we're doing telehealth therapy, and we're doing it online. And we want to make sure those platforms are secure.
I want to just point out a few things that I think probably overlap with some of the benefits that were already discussed. But one of those, I think, is immediacy. So there are certain technologies that allow us to do things more immediately. And I think that can have its downsides, but we're highlighting the benefits right now. So a couple examples are things like social media, right? If you're doing an evaluation of mental state at the time of the offense, if somebody's rambling a bunch of things online and you can see the time dates and how that progresses. And so you might be able to see, I mean, assuming you authenticate that and know that that came from the person that you're in fact evaluating, but you can see sometimes people's thoughts and behaviors more in the moment when either right before they're about to commit a crime or in the context of threat assessment. So you have maybe some more immediate documentation of what is going on in somebody's mind. On the treatment side of things, like thinking about some of these applications, I'm also working on a mobile app that is for individuals on community supervision, and it's kind of this e-therapy, kind of self-guided, but also supplemented by counselor or probation officer engagement. But things like that can help people address things that are happening to them or respond to things that are happening to them more in the moment, right? Instead of, oh, I gotta, you know, go back home and complete my thought log or whatever, they can jump on these apps and they can record their thoughts more immediately, and they can actually apply some of the things that they're learning in treatment or therapy to when it actually happens to them right now in that time and space. Another benefit that I don't think was brought up was in the context of training, not just training students, but training other people who work in criminal legal contexts, or maybe civil legal contexts as well. But for example, there's been a few efforts looking at things like virtual reality to train correctional officers to address assaultive behavior or to do de-escalation strategies where, you know, practicing those things in real time would be kind of dangerous, right? To have somebody swing at you while you're learning to deal with these things. But, you know, having some simulation of dealing with those circumstances might increase their preparedness for the job, which may have implications for burnout and turnover, and they're just better equipped to kind of deal with some of these scenarios that they might be dealing with. And kind of a similar thing with virtual reality in the context of, again, treatment of people with offense histories and helping them learn and understand how to problem solve certain things. Or I've seen virtual reality interventions that have them kind of walk through everyday life scenarios, like maybe they haven't been to a grocery store in a while, or they haven't, you know, gone to the bank, or, you know, those sorts of things. They kind of practice doing those things using virtual reality. So I think those are kind of two things that present some benefits, if it's done right. I mean, you know, virtual reality has to also be realistic and immersive, and, you know, I've seen some that are a little bit questionable and look a little bit amateurish, but there's some discussion about how to, again, leverage and really use some of those tools to better prepare people for their jobs, for reentry, and those kinds of things that can't be as well simulated with real people because there's danger and there's safety concerns. So.
Uh,
I guess one of the benefits that I also see is that technology can be a way to bridge a language gap, like across disciplines. And I think that's a big thing, because for us as clinicians or evaluators or whatever, we're on one side of things and we're often having to communicate to other disciplines who don't speak our same language. And that was kind of one of the rationales for that I developed in the first place as well, was we had law enforcement officers who are reaching their conclusions about somebody's suicidality, and mental health professionals at receiving facilities having different opinions or different understandings when that person comes into contact, because the way the law enforcement officers are communicating it is just not in the same language that we use. And so finding a way to bridge that gap can kind of solve a lot of problems in terms of communication. So I think that's one of the biggest, I think, values that I see of technology, is sometimes it's just giving us a way to communicate with each other and have the same language to talk about a problem.
I had a third thing and I forgot it, but you reminded me, and then I'll pass it over to you, that's okay. The third thing I was thinking of, so accessibility was already mentioned, but I think it was mentioned mostly in the context of increasing access to a service provider. But you might also think about accessibility in terms of disability and cultural applications. So even something as simple as someone being able to turn volume up on Zoom, or having closed captioning, or other kinds of accessibility features that we can't mimic or do as adults, or not young, as evaluators or service providers, being in person with individuals, that might be more easy to do with the assistance of technology.
Just one quick thing. Apps are really getting more and more involved in therapy, such as PTSD Coach for people with trauma. There's wonderful apps out there, the Virtual Hope Box for people who are treating with suicidal, where they put things that remind them of why they want to be alive. So we're able to incorporate these tools. NAMI in San Diego spent close to $3 million creating an app for everyone in San Diego that lists when do you need to see someone, it directs you where to go, it tells you where the agencies are. They have one for children, they have one for adults, it's called Oscar and Oscar Junior, and they have one for kids who may need educational support called Alfredo. And these are things that are really assisting, and they're assisting law enforcement when they run into someone who may need a referral. So the concept of interconnecting becomes important. In San Diego, we have an app to help us with homelessness that could immediately assess where beds are available. And so these are some of the things that we're going to be able to do as we move forward, and I'm very excited about.
Just want to quickly give folks a chance to start thinking about questions. We'll just close out with one or two questions from all of y'all after Laura's done.
I'll keep it very brief, because you took the words right out of my mouth. I was going to, beautifully. I was going to talk about accessibility in terms of how we can adapt technology for different audiences. So thank you. And that's kind of what I mean when I touch on the word sustainability, in terms of how do we build a legacy with these technological platforms, in terms of right now they are suitable for what we've designed them for, but like how can we take them further? So how can we do text-to-speech for individuals that require that? How can we do enlarged text for individuals that need that? In my context in Kenya, where they speak so many different languages, how can I do translation work, or how can I allow voice recording, as my voice goes. I went to the Lakers game last night, so sorry, my voice is breaking. So how can we make sure that this is accessible for all? And touching on your point about age discrimination or digital divides in my context. So whilst technology is a wonderful, wonderful answer, it might not be the answer for everyone. So whilst in Kenya they do have a lot of mobile phone technology, what they lack is Wi-Fi and data. So what we do there is we have paper and pen printouts of the exact same questionnaire that you can have. And we also train, cheeky plug, we're about to do a talk in 20 minutes on training first responders to do this, because they don't have some of the training that we have necessarily. So training them how to take these documentation of sexual violence. So we have the app, we have a paper and pen format, and we have a human being that's able to do it. So we are offering
plans A through Z and voice recordings, because we need to consider accessibility and that one tech is not going to be suitable for all.
I just want to say thank you. I feel like in so much of the work that we do, we have to hold a lot of nuance, and I think that's what's been brought into this conversation. So just appreciative of that. As tech continues to evolve, I'm just wondering how you're staying abreast with all this. I had no idea about the VR stuff, so now I have to like go home and Google all of this. And I'm just wondering what it is that you're doing to ensure that we can't always know, we can't always be all knowing. And I'm curious if you have any resources or areas that you go to seek out this knowledge.
Well, for some reason, people ask me to talk about this, and so in preparing for various presentations and things of that nature, I try to make sure that I know what the hell I'm talking about most of the time. Looking to things that, I don't know if this is going to be well received, but I think our field of psychology and law sometimes lags in terms of other sectors of mental health and psychology, especially when it does come to technology. Even just thinking about the acceptability of telehealth, that was way more accepted by people doing general therapy and assessment long before our field decided it was okay for us. I know we work in litigious contexts and things of that nature, but I think sometimes we think we're more important than other sectors of the field. But looking to what other areas are doing. So I mentioned earlier the APA Monitor on Psychology. They're always talking about trends in technology, even outside of their typical trends report. That's just one thing. Or looking at other kind of mainstream discussions about where the mental health field is going and thinking about how that could apply to our work or what kind of modifications would need to be applied so that it can be used ethically with people who are involved in the legal system. But I guess that would be my kind of general advice, would be to look outside of our little bubble and see what are other people doing, and could that be something that would be useful for us as well. And along those lines, I think we sometimes separate forensic work, pretrial evaluations, from the correctional work, and those areas can learn a lot from each other. So there's a lot of like the VR stuff that's going on in the corrections world, but could apply very similarly to competency restoration or other kinds of inpatient forensic services. So I think there's some learning that we can do within, you know, among each other within the field, but also outside the field and what people are doing generally. And again, looking at things like, you know, things that APA is putting out, or the American Psychiatric Association, other kind of partnering organizations. There's also the American Telemedicine Association, I believe, that has conference and discussions about these kinds of things.
Just building on that, if that's okay, because I was going to answer the exact same way, that we need to be interdisciplinary, we need to be looking outside of our field. And one of the ways that we've been doing it at the University of Birmingham, which I absolutely love, is they call it a data sand pit. And it basically means that a bunch of researchers get to go and have fun together. And so we'll have people from like computer science, psychology, law, all different schools from our university, and we all go sit in our sand pit. It's not an actual sand pit, obviously. It's
a
picture. I know, I wish it was an actual sand pit, but that's what they call it. So we get to go and share our toys. So we go and we offer kind of a brief presentation on the key problems, and they could either be data that we hold, or it could be a question from the non-governmental organization that I work with, and I get to go and pitch it, and I get to say, this is a problem that we have, this is data that we have, and I would really love to know what you think and what you would do with this. And that is actually where a lot of these projects were born, is I have a fantastic team of computer scientists that then essentially speed dated with me, which was a bit weird, but it did work, and they come and sit with me and they say, this is what I would do with that. And that's where a lot of these ideas are born. And this was just a completely in-house event. It didn't cost a lot to put on, and if it's something that people could do elsewhere, a lot of great ideas were born from that interdisciplinary event. You don't need to use the word data sampling.
I think one of the things is make friends who know a lot more than you do, and that really helps. So, I mean, a couple of years ago with Marlene Mayhew, who's written a lot in this area, I had an opportunity. We try to build a neuropsychological assessment in senior care homes in Texas. And then how do you do that? That's always an issue. Pearson has its guidelines of how you can get an MMPI. How do you know they're filling it out? How do you watch? How many cameras you need? I mean, these are the sort of conversations sometimes you get into when you're looking at issues of assessment. But the other thing is cross-discipline, as you said. Tuesday, I'm getting together with the folks who come up with software and look at software. So the LACCs, which are throughout the country, which are the computer assessment centers to look what's going on, often provide training. If you get on their lists, then you can go and hear what they've come up with and what are the latest threats. Because we need to know everything about sextortion, about cyberbullying, and all those types of things. They inform how we look at it when we do our work online.
This isn't exactly like a tangible like training or anything, but I think, and I tell this to students in general, but having flexibility and having an open mind as you work through your career, because as we've all kind of alluded to, a lot of us in this field were like, oh, no, I cannot do something via Zoom. Where's the sensitivity? Where's the security? How do I know? I don't know what this person smells like. How can I comment on their mental status? Like all these things that we're also very concerned about is all ending up pretty okay. We're still doing pretty well even through all these things. And I think I work with students, I work with faculty from all different age groups, age ranges, and I think regardless of your comfortability with technology, if you're open to learning about it, if you're open to thinking in a different way, that really brings out the best ideas. And to, I think, whatever the people have talked about, make friends that you can bounce ideas off of. Even think outside, not just our like bubble, but even our discipline. Like I'm going to an ed tech conference for my position as an educator, and I'm going to be looking at, okay, is there any things that we can help students learn about clinical interviewing? Are there tools that we can utilize or purchase to help our students gain skills in those areas on a computer potentially? And so, yeah, I think just think very broadly and think flexibly.
Yeah, I was just going to kind of echo that sentiment. I think talking to people outside of the mental health world altogether can be really helpful. Having friends who work in tech is, I think, been a really great benefit because I can come to them with like kind of troubleshooting the issues that I have, not being super tech savvy, and getting, I guess, novel solutions to problems or stick points that I'm having can be really helpful. And also then, I guess, like picking their brains about like maybe current projects that they're working on, even if they have nothing to do with the field of psychology, can kind of give you ideas for how you could apply those solutions to the problems that we're having.
I forgot we only have one.
Well, I just want to say thank you all. I really appreciate it. And on the note of tech, our plan A for the podcast seems to fall apart. So we have plan B, which is great. I just thought that was fitting of it.
It's
a tech conversation.
Yeah,
so cool.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a whole other talk about fail-safe plans
exactly.
That you've got to have.
Thank you very much. And thank you all for joining us today. I really appreciate it.
Where's the sensitivity? Where's the security? How do I know? I don't know what this person smells like. How can I comment on their mental status? Like all these things that we're also very concerned about is all ending up pretty okay. We're still doing pretty well even through all these things. And I think I work with students, I work with faculty from all different age groups, age ranges, and I think regardless of your comfortability with technology, if you're open to learning about it, if you're open to thinking in a different way, that really brings out the best ideas. And to, I think, whatever the people have talked about, make friends that you can bounce ideas off of. Even think outside, not just our like bubble, but even our discipline. Like I'm going to an ed tech conference for my position as an educator, and I'm going to be looking at, okay, is there any things that we can help students learn about clinical interviewing? Are there tools that we can utilize or purchase to help our students gain skills in those areas on a computer potentially? And so, yeah, I think just think very broadly and think flexibly.
Yeah, I was just going to kind of echo that sentiment. I think talking to people outside of the mental health world altogether can be really helpful. Having friends who work in tech is, I think, been a really great benefit because I can come to them with like kind of troubleshooting the issues that I have, not being super tech savvy, and getting, I guess, novel solutions to problems or stick points that I'm having can be really helpful. And also then, I guess, like picking their brains about like maybe current projects that they're working on, even if they have nothing to do with the field of psychology, can kind of give you ideas for how you could apply those solutions to the problems that we're having.
Well, I just want to say thank you all. I really appreciate it. And on the note of tech, our plan A for the podcast seems to fall apart. So we have plan B, which is great. I just thought that was fitting of it. I've been tech conversation.
Yeah, that's a whole other talk about fail-safe plans that you've got to have.
Thank you very much. And thank you all for joining us today. I really appreciate it.